Hello, and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and I'm delighted to have you with me today. Last week, I promised you that we were going to speak today about access to services, and we are going to do that, but not today. I'm going to put that one off until next week, if you don't mind, because there's an article that was released today from the Journal of Cancer Research, and I think it's going to make some headlines, but that the headlines are not going to get at the real meat of this article. So I'd like to help to get it in perspective for everyone. The real news here is for esophageal cancer of the esophagus. But I think the headlines are going to center around breast cancer. So let's talk about this and we'll understand it. There is some very exciting news in here underneath all the technical jargon. So we're going to speak with Dr. Adam Wax, who is a professor of biomedical engineering at Duke University, and he's going to help us understand what's going on here. So please stay with us. I have a message here from our sponsor, and then we'll be right back to speak with Dr. Wax. The Powerful Patient is brought to you by the VHL Family Alliance. That stands for von Hippel-Lindau disease, and we'll talk a little bit more about VHL during other parts of the program. This show is for anyone who is managing a complex medical condition or a disability, and we talk about things that all of us can share and need to know about. So please stay with us, and we'll see today's program here in just a second. The paper we're going to be discussing today was just released in the Journal of Cancer Research, and it's about a new light scattering technology from the folks at the Biomedical Research Institute at Duke University. Okay, now take a deep breath, and I don't want you to think like you have to understand every little word, but think in terms of analogies to something that you do understand, some mechanical thing. Even if you think you don't understand about auto mechanics or whatever, think about sewing machines or tape recorders or whatever you do understand. Or pulleys, or bringing a bucket up from a well. We all deal with a certain amount of mechanical stuff. And so we have some analogies that we can bring to bear. And go ahead and let yourself free associate to something that you do understand. So light scattering, obviously, as if it were marbles or pebbles or something, we can scatter the light. And light usually moves in a straight line. And so when they pick up the ways that the light scatters, they learn different things about the texture or the configuration inside of the cell. So we're down at a teeny tiny level, but the principles are still the same. And I think it's going to be very interesting to delve deeply into this with him, because we're in a position now where there are tremendous advances being made in science, and a lot of it, obviously, we don't understand. Don't worry about it. Even if you get a room full of scientists, probably 80 to 90% of them won't understand everything that goes on in that room anyway. So it's all very specialized. But what you and I need to focus on is how we're going to get this stuff out of the lab and into the clinic. And that process is called translation. So how do we translate these wonderful new advances down deep in the cell that people are playing with in their little petri dishes, their little glass dishes in the lab, and get that to be something meaningful that helps real human beings with real diseases in the clinic? And I think you'll find this discussion pretty interesting in that respect. So hang on to your hat, take a deep breath, don't worry too much, but stay with me in the conversation. I have some more information also in the handout that will be helpful to you. So if you go to powerfulpatient.org and pick up the handout there, that should help as well. So I have today one of the authors of this paper, Dr. Adam Wax, who is an assistant professor of biomedical engineering at Duke. Welcome, Dr. Wax.
So is this in the realm of molecular imaging?
We are getting structural information about a molecular event. So what we're seeing is the pre-programmed cell death that is supposed to occur regularly for cells, but becomes unglued for cancer cells.
Right. So when we talk about cell death, or apoptosis is the official word, right?
Right.
This is, as you say, a normal part of the cycle of the life of a cell, and our bodies are constantly renewing themselves. So certain cells are supposed to die off at a certain point and be replaced by new cells, right?
Exactly, yes. The new cells are created, they go through a maturation, and then they are supposed to die, similar to our own life cycles.
Okay, and then part of the cancer profile is that certain cells sort of outlive their time.
They become immortal, and they actually, you know, continue to grow, and they continue to reproduce, and it's that unchecked proliferation that, you know, actually results in the cancer.
So it's that cell growth out of control when some of these were supposed to have died off.
Exactly.
So when we talk about death in this respect, this is a good thing.
Yes, this is the one time when death would be viewed as a good thing.
Right. So now, with your new technology, tell us a little bit about this. I'm probably going to mangle the pronunciation, but it's angle-resolved low-coherence interferometry?
Interferometry, yeah. It's a mouthful. We usually abbreviate it as ALCI. And the idea is that we scatter light off the cell nuclei, and it tells us about their size and shape. The interferometry part is what lets us get depth resolution. So if you took a flashlight and just shined it through your hand, for example, the light scatters around a whole lot, and it's difficult to find the light that's interacted only one time with a particular cell nucleus. Mm-hmm. So we use this interferometry to select light that's only interacted with, say, a specific tissue layer. In our experiments that were described in this paper, we were looking at a layer of cancer cells that was grown in vitro. So it was a monolayer of cells in a dish.
Right. My particular interest in chatting with you today is that there's a comment in this press release that is going to make some headlines. It's like, how many times have we seen things like mouse cures cancer, and that was 30 years ago. So, what makes good headlines isn't always going to make it to the clinic real fast.
And no, I understand
that completely.
So I wanted
to get some perspective on that and sort of help our listeners get it in perspective. So the quote I'm thinking of is from Ostrander, and it says, if we had a way to detect early on in the apoptotic process whether or not a drug was working, patients would not have to wait weeks to months to find out. The idea that you could shine a light at a tumor and use the light scattering pattern to measure the success of drugs is a big step forward. Well, yeah, but we're not quite there yet, right?
Well, a lot of things would have to happen for this to make it into clinical practice. You're talking about translational research.
Right.
So probably before we started, examining patients with this, we would do an animal study where, there are many animal models of cancer, and we would monitor whether our light scattering device could detect this effect in those mice.
Right.
Promising results there would then lead to, clinical trials in humans.
Right. So help me understand where you are today. As I understand it, you've been working with cell lines.
Mm-hmm.
These are cells that reproduce in the lab so that you have almost an immortal family of cells that goes on. And you've been using these cell lines in petri dishes in the lab.
Right.
And you can shine your light directly on those cells in the petri dish, right?
Yes.
Are you at the point where you can shine it on a tumor?
Well, we actually are in clinical trials with this technology. So we initially developed this technology to look for precancerous lesions.
Mm-hmm.
So before there's a painful bleeding mass or before there's even a lesion that's visible to the doctor, cells make this first fundamental change down the road towards cancer, and that's often called dysplasia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you've got one of these at-risk conditions, meaning you've got an increased likelihood of developing cancer, and I'm talking things like irritable bowel disease, such as ulcerative colitis, or specifically Barrett's esophagus is one that we're going after, then
so
typically...
So this is a precancerous condition for esophageal cancer, preferring
yes.
the cancer of the esophagus.
Well, Barrett's esophagus is a precancerous condition, but it can, some patients okay. have dysplasia, which would be a precancerous condition.
So it sounds like you're starting with tissues where we can see the tissue and shine a light on the tissue without being particularly invasive.
Right. So our device is a fiber optic probe. It goes down the biopsy channel and endoscope. We put it in contact with the esophageal tissue. And then by measuring the size of the cell nuclei, we can tell if any precancerous lesions are present. This is a sharp improvement compared to the current methods where they're hunting around for this using a random biopsy. So they're taking, you know, systematic biopsies and then trying to uncover a cancer. That's only got about a 2% tissue coverage rate, whereas with our device, you could scan, you know, the entire tissue if you were interested.
Uh-huh. That's very good. So we can put this light down someone's throat
mm-hmm.
and shining the light on it, and then how are you picking up the signals that come back?
So there's a delivery fiber that brings the light down, and then there's a bundle that collects all of the angular scattering from the cell nuclei. And by looking at those angular scattering patterns, we can determine their size. Now, in the study that you called me about, that we were talking about, we're actually there looking at the texture of the cell nuclei. So rather than the changes in size, what we're seeing is a change in the organization of the genetic material inside. And this is indicating that it's proceeding down the road towards apoptosis.
Okay, so in the esophagus one, we're looking for precancerous cells and trying to see if those cells are on the way toward turning nasty on you.
Yes.
But in the one in the article, we're talking about checking to see if a particular drug that's in clinical trial is doing its job.
Exactly.
Okay, so we take this drug in hopes of killing the cancer cells, and it would be nice to know as soon as possible whether that drug is in fact effective for this particular tumor or this particular individual.
Well, sort of what happens now is, you know, if you're diagnosed with a cancer and they want to give you chemotherapy, what they'll do is they'll measure the size of your tumor before you receive any drugs.
Right.
After going through the regimen, you know, 6 or 8 weeks later, they'll come back and they'll measure the size again. And if the tumor is viewed to have shrunk, then they deem that the cancer-fighting drugs are working.
Right.
Now, with our approach, we're actually able to see evidence of the molecular action using these morphology measurements within just an hour and a half.
So how can you see them? Breast cancer is the example that Ms. Ostrander was talking about. Or what? Give us an example of what it would be.
So one way that we could, you know, implement this fairly quickly would be to do a fine needle aspiration. So take, you know, a small sample of that tumor, put the cells into a culture dish, give them the chemotherapeutic drug, and then do our measurement to see if that chemotherapy is, in fact, inducing apoptosis. There are many different types of cancers, and they don't all respond equally to the same chemotherapeutic drugs because they work by different mechanisms.
Right, exactly. And if you could tell within a day or two, as opposed to 6 weeks, one of the big differences, which is a very big difference, is after 6 weeks, you've already taken, what, $50,000 worth of drug and gone through
aside from the cost, it's the wear on the patient. I mean, you know, you've gotten sick from this chemo. You've used up a lot of your reserves trying to fight the cancer. But instead you've directed it towards, you know, just fighting the drug. So this way, you know, an unsuccessful chemotherapeutic could be abandoned in favor of one that might be more promising.
Right, and we don't know how to test in advance with all these drugs to know which one's going to work for this person. Some of the new cancer drugs only work for 15% of the people who take them.
That's right.
So testing it. Testing and getting this feedback early is wonderful. But as you say, you have to look at the cell. So if it's not on the surface of your throat, as it is in the esophageal example, you have to retrieve some cells somehow
mm-hmm.
with this fine needle aspiration is one way to do that. So it's basically you have to have a biopsy every time you want to measure success, right?
Potentially, the idea of a needle probe would also work. Or if the surface of the cancer was available laparoscopically, that would be another way that we could access that tissue.
Right. So for colon or something, if you can get at it with mm-hmm. your light without puncturing the skin, then that would be great. But in many cases, for kidney or for breast or for lung even, we're talking about a somewhat more invasive procedure.
Well, our technique is applicable to any epithelial cancer. So whether that's an oral cavity, the lining of the digestive tract, the cervix, the bladder. In fact, 85% of all cancers do start in the epithelium. So ultimately, it may be a brain cancer that causes the patient mortality, but that cancer may have actually started in epithelial tissue in, say, the colon.
Right. So epithelial tissue is like skin or mucous membranes, the coatings mm-hmm. on things, the coating on the inside of our bowel and so forth.
Right. So you could imagine that if you came into contact with a nasty carcinogen, the place it would impact you soonest would be an epithelial tissue, because that's the part of our body that comes in contact with the environment.
Right.
Let's take a little break here, and we'll be right back to speak some more with Dr. Wax about other potential clinical applications and how they're making progress toward translating this into the clinic. Hi, I'm Joyce Graff, the host of The Powerful Patient. For some 40 years, I've worked with people with von Hippel-Lindau disease, a tiny misspelling in one gene, the VHL gene, that causes tumors in 6 different areas of the body. Why these areas? What do they have in common? Interestingly, as we study VHL, we're learning about what causes cancer for everyone. The VHL gene is on the main superhighway for tumor development in many cancers. The answer we need for VHL is part of the answer we need for all. Won't you help us find a cure for cancer? People with VHL are donating their tissue and their blood to move this forward. Won't you please donate some money to help? Please give at VHL.org. We want to make VHL stand for Very Happy Life. That's VHL.org. Thank you. We're back now talking with Dr. Adam Wax, an assistant professor of biomedical engineering at Duke University in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
You're in human trials with the esophageal
right.
problem. And what else?
We've done some animal studies in the trachea, which is the respiratory tract.
Yeah.
And we've done some initial looking at the colon. And we have had some discussions about doing it in the bladder and some other organs. But, there's a substantial cost and effort required to get these trials underway. We are really focused on getting our technology into the clinic. We want to try and have an impact on, the monitoring and surveillance of cancer. And we view esophageal cancer as the best candidate for our technology. Because of this condition of Barrett's esophagus that's rapidly growing in the United States, there's an increased need to monitor those tissues. Esophageal cancer is also one of the cancers with the least favorable outcome. So there are 15,000 new cancers every year, esophageal cancers, and there are 15,000 deaths every year. The 5-year survival rate is a paltry 20%. So.
Wow. Now, you're saying that you're seeing some changes in the cells even 6 hours after they begin taking certain drugs.
Yes. We see an early change in the mitochondria, which are the powerhouses of the cell. They generate energy for the cell. So you could see, just from a layman's point of view, that if you were going to cause a pre-programmed cell death, one of the things you would have to do is shut down the powerhouse of the cell. Then at 6 hours, we see a change in the cell nucleus, and this is actually an indication that apoptosis is beginning to occur. So what happens in apoptosis is the cell nucleus, which contains the genetic material that helps the cell reproduce, it begins to break down. And what we see is the fragmentation of that genetic material.
Uh-huh. Okay. So if we were going to use it for something like the breast cancer that mm-hmm. Was suggested in the article, we would need to give the drug and then the next day maybe do a fine needle aspiration of the tumor and take those cells and put them under your light to check them out, right?
That would be the way that we would do it using the current technology. But we have talked about developing a very fine fiber optic probe that perhaps would fit down the ducts of the breast. Or, you know, we do have some depth penetration. We can see 1 or 2 millimeters into the tissue. So if we had some access that was, you know, closer to the tumor, we might be able to see it somewhat less invasively.
Mm-hmm. So there's a hope for, you have a vision of doing this less invasively over time as the technology improves?
Yes. I mean, this is, you know, how we developed it for the esophagus. So we started initially with cells in a dish. We did our animal studies, which were very successful. And this was convincing to the NIH that we should get a grant to be able to develop a version for use in the clinic, which mm-hmm. is exactly what we've developed. And so, you know, now we're doing it under support from a foundation, the Coulter Foundation, that sponsors translational research to actually do a clinical feasibility trial.
Sounds good. So if someone is interested in this esophageal trial, mm-hmm. is there some way that they can contact you or someone to talk about potential enrollment?
Sure. We are doing clinical trials at the University of North Carolina Clinic at Meadowmont. If they wanted to get in touch with me here, I'd be happy to refer them to the clinical trial. My information is available on the web. It's appropriate for me to give an email or something.
Sure, that's fine, and I'll have it in the handout also that goes with this show.
Okay.
And so we have a.wax@duke.edu.
That's right.
Is that right?
Okay. And, you know, I don't technically enroll people in the trial. It's, you know, there's a trial administrator over there. It's just the way things are done, but I'll be glad to refer them if they're interested. But, yeah, if anyone's interested, they can contact me. I'm always glad to talk with people, so.
Okay. So does this open the door to additional technologies that may jump off from this? Tell us what your vision is of the future with the path that you're on.
Well, we would like to do for esophageal cancer what you know, Katie Couric did for colon cancer, really improve the screening so that people are more aware of their esophageal health. I think a lot of the cancers that are seen these days are completely preventable if people were just more aware of them earlier on.
And what kinds of things are done early to help you if you're found to have some of these precancerous cells?
Well, if we find them while they're still localized in the tissue, then there are, you know, several avenues. There are, you know, chemopreventive drugs that are under trial. There's a new radiofrequency ablation technique that will actually remove just, you know, gentle layers of that tissue. And, you know, what they're showing is that it's, you know, leading to complete recovery. So
screening your esophagus becomes as doable as a colonoscopy.
Right. Once you get away from having to do the random biopsies, it does become a lot more feasible. And they actually have endoscopes now that will go through the nose, and you could probably do that right in the doctor's office if you didn't have to worry about potential bleeding from taking the biopsy.
Right, right. And can they do some minor repairs while they're in there, or like they do with a colon, or not?
Yeah, the same kind of model. So, you know, in the colon, what you're doing is you're plucking off polyps. And there's a risk of bleeding, so they prefer to do that, you know, in a clinic.
Right.
But if you were just taking a look around and using a fiber optic probe to assess tissue health, then you could do it in the doctor's office. And if anything was found, then you would go have a follow-up, either an ablation or, you know, be prescribed some sort of drug.
Right. So, but this is not widely available, of course, at this point, right? It's just in trials.
We're in trials. We actually founded a company called Oncoscope, and it is, you know, commercially developing this technology, and we hope to be able to sell it sometime in the near future. We are currently working on an application to the FDA, which would let us sell this device.
Okay, and if all goes well, you would expect to see it come to market in how many years?
I'd like to say, well, once we get our FDA approval, we'll be able to sell it, you know, right away. But, you know, I expect it to really in 2010 to be having a market.
So it should take probably another 2 years to see it come to market.
I'm hoping it's within a year that it comes to market.
Oh, that'd be great. Okay. So, yes, going through the FDA approval cycle is not an easy chore, but
the documentation is thick.
Yeah, somebody once said it was about the size of a trailer truck.
if it were
all paper, it's about the size of a paper trailer truck.
It is. I mean, and we're just preparing all these, you know, 3-ring binders with all the papers that they need. We've done efficacy studies, safety studies, and we've almost got the application complete.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, thank you very much. Is there anything else that we ought to know about that I don't even know enough to ask you? Go ahead.
As a biomedical researcher, it's really exciting for me to see something beginning to have a clinical impact. You know, very often people, as you say, will do a study and then at the end of the paper write, well, this has application to early cancer detection or application to chemotherapy. And then no one ever does that follow-up work to see that it gets there.
Right.
And, that's why I placed a priority in my research to make sure that it does have an impact on the clinic.
Yes, and you're to be congratulated for that. I'm really glad to see that you've got the translation well underway to get this, as they say, from the bench to the bedside. You know, take it out of the lab and get it into the clinic as soon as possible and really see some human benefit here.
Exactly.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Adam. I appreciate your time.
Sure.
And it's been great to have you all with us today as well. A couple of acronyms. The NIH is the U.S. National Institutes of Health. They're one of the major funders of this kind of medical research in the world. And I let a couple of other medical terms slip by, mitochondria and things like that, because they're really not relevant to the discussion. As he said, these are elements within the cell. They serve as the powerhouses for the cell. And so it's important to keep them healthy until you want the cell to die, in which case you want them to turn off their power and begin to respond to the drug. So two good things coming out of this article. And again, it's an early technology, has yet to be proven, but is looking very hopeful. And I think one of the important things about this study is that they have focused on translating this basic research into something that will become a product and become a process in the lab that can really help human beings in a timely manner. So getting it to market by 2010 will be really wonderful. So this is in a new category of examining the cell itself, examining the genetic material in the cell, gathering information, as he said, about what's going on in the cell so that we can see it more readily and begin to make decisions based on that information. This is a new area called molecular imaging, and it's something that we're going to talk about more as we go forward. It's still fairly early, but to be able to look inside the cell and tell what's going on is pretty phenomenal. And as you can see, being able to do that for purposes of epithelial cancers, the ones that deal in the surfaces of our body, both the surfaces inside, like the colon and the esophagus, as well as our skin, and taking a good look at the cells of those epithelium and making sure that they're healthy is going to be a very exciting area of technology as we move forward. So next week, we are, in fact, going to talk with Beth Dworetsky from Family Voices of Massachusetts about obtaining services for people with special needs, not only in Massachusetts, but throughout the United States, employing the network that Family Voices has created across the country. Here's a parting word from Keith Richards with background music from our own Clinton Winford. Clinton Winford II and his wonderful music are obtainable also from the Powerful Patient website.
This is Keith Richards, a.k.a. Just Saying. Is there cancer in your family? There is in mine. But it doesn't have to be bad. We can take action to protect ourselves. I've learned how to get screened and manage my health so that I'll live a long, healthy life. How about you? Visit www.powerfulpatient.org. Again, that's www.powerfulpatient.org. Peace.
And as always, Keith and Clinton and I hope that you will be with us again next week. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient.